Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, our old friend medievalist Jana Matthews is back. I always enjoy having her on, and I always learn a lot from her. After that, I include the second part of my conversation with Alicia from Woolshift Dust, who is covering the House of Usher adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's short story. I do take listener emails, book@baldmove.com. All right, without further ado, here is Dr. Jana Matthews. Jana, I want to talk about a lot of things related to this chapter, but I want to notice first off that when Kat gets back to River Run, she kind of assumes the role of matriarch in a way that almost supersedes her younger brother, who's sort of acting lord of the castle.
Yeah, that's, I mean, totally fascinating. And I think it fits really nicely with the role of the oldest daughter. And we kind of, there's memes and jokes about that on TikTok all the time about, and I think that as I was rereading this section, it reminded me of that, that Kat is, you know, falls into that category of somebody who really runs the household and kind of whips in this case, sort of the castle or the kingdom into shape. And she also chides her brother.
Yeah.
Right, for his, I think, was like his whoring and wenching. And so I think is not afraid to call out bad behavior and uses that moral stance to kind of justify her taking over and, you know, doing some house cleaning.
It's almost like, I don't know if she chides him, but it's sort of like she wants to dismiss it like, look, we're talking around something. I'm going to be direct with you. I know how things work in the world. Let's move on to more important things.
Absolutely.
And he kind of blushes about it because he kind of, you know, would prefer that, you know, he seems lordly or something. Whereas she's kind of viewing him as, you're my little brother and I know how you act. Let's pass right on by your wenching and move on to more important things.
Yeah. And there's also this sense of that there's multiple ways that she really understands how to run a kingdom, and a kingdom is about the, like as you said, the logistics and about getting your hands dirty and doing the practical work. And he's about performance and performativity, about what a lord looks like. And she knows what to do and is kind of like, well, it's, you know, it's time to stop playing around.
In 10 days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre, We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Not only that, but she openly questions his battle strategy, which it seems to me, and I'll ask for your correction, but it seems to me like if she were just ordering people around the castle, that's fine, that's her domain, even if it's not, you know, actually her castle anymore.
Sure.
But to kind of like openly question battle strategy is, it's almost like, look, if you're going to do that, we got to do that in private here. I can't have you besmirching my manhood in public.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't pull any punches when she, she comes in into, there's definitely a rank pulling that happens. Mm. And it's this sort of historically unconventional mode where, as the younger brother, regardless of your gender, you know, you're still in a position of power. Mm. She steps in and she says, okay, well, that's fine. You can hold that title, but I'm the one who's going to call the shots here. And also she demonstrates pretty quickly that she has spent her time gathering information and synthesizing that. And so she's much better equipped than he is. Mm-hmm. She's much more concerned about domestic, personal, issues to wage this war, to be able to, manage what's coming next.
I'll read my introduction to this chapter. So this is Kat's fifth POV in Clash. On the ride to River Run, Kat is met by a scout who is meant to escort her home. Brienne asks to return to the Stormlands, but Kat asks her to fight for Rob. Brienne suggests that she would rather be a liege to Kat herself, provided that Kat will not hold her from avenging Renly's death. The two women exchange vows and continue on to River Run. Once home, Edmure and Kat exchange stories, and Kat second-guesses her brother's battle plans. She visits her dying father and views the bones of her dead husband. Dr. Jana Matthews, what shall we talk about today?
Ooh, there's so much to talk about, but I would love to talk about Brienne because she is such an interesting character.
I know. I was thinking, you know, when I saw this chapter coming up, I thought, I got to see if Jana's available. I have a number of questions about Brienne, but
I'd like to
hear you talk a little bit about Brienne, and it could be that some of my questions are answered.
I mean, she's a fascinating character and an invention. But also is kind of pulled from historical precedent, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But as the sole child of Lord Delatarth, she is in a really unique position. And she normally, I think, would be married off historically. And that would be her kind of the way of keeping the lineage alive. But also her role would be in relationship to her husband or to a male relative. But she doesn't do that. She turns down opportunities to marry kind of right and left. And she's also interestingly like named Maid of Tarth, and also throughout this chapter referred to as Beauty, or like, which is a nickname for Brienne the Beauty, which is in reference, a kind of a mocking reference to her untraditional or non-conventional feminine, you know, female looks. Like, she's not viewed as being conventionally pretty. And I think that that's an interesting thing to think about, that you can't, that in this text, or at least with the figure of Brienne, you can't have both. She can't be conventionally pretty. She has to look like a man, right? And both in stature and also in comportment. And that was an interesting stylistic choice, which we can and can't talk about. But I mean, I think you mentioned that she started out as being wanting to be a liege and dedicate herself to following Kat. And that kind of comes on the heels of serving as part of Renly Baratheon's Kingsguard, mm-hmm. which is of itself a notable feat because she is a woman. And when he dies and she witnesses that death, she's taken a vow an informal vow, right, to seek revenge on him. And that relationship between Renly and Brienne, at least in the sort of the backstory or history of that, is important and interesting because he is one of the only people that defends her, that doesn't mock her, mm-hmm. for encourages her for being who she is. And so she's kind of devastated when he dies. So there's an interesting humanizing component of who she is, but also helps explain why she's on kind of a rampage, to put it mildly, at least later on in the series, to seek out justice.
All right. So I'm glad that you brought up the liege thing, because that was one of my questions. And I guess this is a question sort of beyond my expertise. But what she suggests is that I could be your liege man, or whatever you would have me be.
Yeah.
And she uses the word man, like, I could be your man. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, and of course, I think that elsewhere she, you know, eschews the title lady.
Yes.
And so the question is this just a title thing? Or does she, or should we be looking at her gender identification differently?
Well, that's a really great question. I think it's both. So there really isn't a vocabulary then, and even maybe up until the past 2 or 3 years, where we've kind of gone gender neutral and started taking a lot of those names and moving them into sort of different kind of categories, mm-hmm. to talk about what it would be like. There, it was inconceivable and also linguistically inconceivable to have a liege woman or a liege person. And so that's part of the reason why she hesitates. Right? So it's part of it's a linguistic thing. I don't fit the category. I don't know what you want to call me. Mm-hmm. I don't really fit into these categories, and I recognize that. So it's partially that, and then partially it's the fact that it's that name goes along with the title, in that she's also, or Brienne's also saying to her, I can't be a knight. It's not within the social structure to allow me. So in addition to not identifying with maybe perhaps either gender, not fitting neatly into that category, I also don't fit neatly into this hierarchy of jobs and duties and titles and responsibilities. And so, I mean, it maybe expresses simultaneous acknowledgement, but also I think it's a moment of implicit power. And Catelyn recognizes that tremendously, because having someone who doesn't fit any categories enables her to really be whatever she wants. Mm. And so that's, isn't that the tension with Brienne throughout, is this, I don't fit in. I don't know if that's a bad thing or a good thing.
I kind of get the sense with Brienne that everything was set up for her to sort of be a failure in the society that, yeah. you know, around her. And yet she was so close to it. I mean, yeah, of course, like, no one's ever going to call her a knight in mm-hmm. this world, but even better than being a knight is being a member of the Rainbow Guard. Right. And she's yeah. never going to like have Renly's love requited, mm-hmm. but maybe even better than that from her view, like, she can be wholly devoted to him and serve, you know, serve in a way that, you know, is on her terms. And so it's almost like, against all odds, things have kind of broken her way. And then just as soon as she has them, they're like, snatched away by dark magic, right? Renly's killed by a shadow, and that's it. And all of the things that she thought she would never have, she finally got, and she just got enough to taste them. And now they're gone. And so I almost feel like we're meeting her at this moment of tragedy in her story.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mention her love for Renly, because I think that's an interesting term. I mean, it's throughout this series, we want to, our natural instinct, and when you think about the television series, there's this constant like, when is Bran going to fall in love? As if that is the only option mm-hmm. for her. And we see that with Renly, and that I think it's, you know, we can read that relationship as unrequited love, or love a romantic love that can never be met as a form of desire, but also can, you know, it could be referring to a different kind of love. It could be like a love of respect and a love of companionship, or a friendship or a brotherhood.
Right.
Or
yeah. The vassal scissor relationship is sometimes described in terms of love.
I've always been described in terms of that. And so I think too, you know, we see her as someone who consistently chooses to exist outside, or by fate chooses to exist outside that paradigm, or resist that mode of love. And she's consistently seen as a failure because of that, right? She's a single woman, but I'm not sure she sees herself as that. And in fact, like, you know, the oaths that she makes, when we think about oath making and the different kinds of oaths, but like, I mean, knights make oaths, but also people who are married and who are in love make oaths. Mm-hmm. The oaths, she's one of the only ones in this whole series and book series who actually keeps the oaths that they make. So she's more devout and more committed than people who make oaths to each other in different contexts. And I think that's a point that Martin, you know, allows her to make and to demonstrate in pretty remarkable ways. Hmm.
I'm just going to read this section from Kat. So far, we only view Brienne through Kat's eyes, right? So this is how Kat views Brienne in this chapter. She says, "Catelyn should not have been surprised. The homely young woman had kept to herself all through the journey, spending most of her time with the horses, brushing out their coats and pulling stones from their shoes. She had helped Shad cook and clean game as well, and soon proved that she could hunt as well as any. Any task Kat asked her to turn her hand to, Brienne had performed deftly without complaint, and when she was spoken to, she answered politely, but she never chattered or wept or laughed. She had ridden with them every day and slept among them every night, without ever truly becoming one of them. It was the same when she was with Renly, Kat thought. At the feast, in the melee, even in Renly's pavilion with her brothers of the Rainbow Guard, there are walls around this one higher than Winterfell's." And so I thought, all right, this is a fascinating window. Of course, Kat can sometimes be an unreliable narrator, but I think that her eyes are pretty astute here. Not only is she kind of observing that Brienne does the work that would normally a man would do, right? The hunting and the work with the outdoor work, basically. Sure. But in addition to that, she almost views Brienne as something of a psychological fortress. Like, there are walls around this one that are higher than Winterfell. I just thought that was an interesting way to introduce a very unique character in the story.
I love that that term, psychological fortress. I think it really applies to Brienne. And at this stage, we don't know if those walls are self-constructed or how much of them. We know that they've been constructed by others, even from the passage that you read, where the people that she's around, the men, don't know what to do with her. But we don't know to what extent she's tried to break through them or what resistance, but all we do know is that they're there.
Right. Yeah. And just to kind of put this chapter in context, pretty close relationship to this chapter, the walls of Winterfell will be breached.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Greyjoys will come to town and the walls will be meaningless. And so I don't know if that's an intentionality thing. I don't know if Martin intends to kind of parallel that, but I'm going to cough here. Give me a minute. Sorry about that. But it's like, yeah, she has high walls around her, but it's not like this is not a fortress that can stand against all, you know, all attackers. So there's a bit of vulnerability to her, and yet she has something of a, I guess, knightly exterior, even though she can't really be called a knight. Which kind of leads me to my next question. Is Brienne a knight? Mm. I mean, you said she's one of the few people that actually keeps her vows, and vows make the knight, right? Mm. So I guess from one perspective, you could say, no, she can't be a knight in this world. But I wonder if you could reflect on that.
This is part of, or drawn from a world where titles and the authority that bequeath them mean everything.
Mm.
And so in that sense, yeah, I mean, like, there's always a gap and a hole where she doesn't have the official, at least at this stage in the game, right, have the official marker or banner as knight. On the other hand, this is also a world where rules are made to be broken and where oaths are not required, right, that they're not documented. And and oftentimes, the most powerful oaths are those that are formed informally.
Hmm.
And so even when you think about, you know, marriage, which is sort of another common oath, right? The idea that you can be considered legal, you can be considered married if you've made a vow to each other. Mm-hmm. And there doesn't have to be other people present for that. And so, I think about Brienne and how that's, the status that she's afforded or the way that she's viewed by other people is essentially of a knight. She doesn't have a lord, an official lord who recognizes her. She doesn't have insignia.
Mm.
She's not part of a larger community. But she looks like a knight. She acts like a knight.
Yeah. She's missing the social structure,
right?
That would make the category work. But it's almost like clinging to Kat might be the closest she's going to get now that Renly's gone.
And it's fascinating that she clings to Kat as a woman. And so she's constructing, the two of them together, constructing an alternative version of knighthood. One where you've got a woman who has the power to bestow and bequeath,
mm-hmm.
That title onto others, and those and the other who has the ability to make a vow and to form that social bond with each other. So it's really kind of this remarkably like subversive act.
Would now be a good time to ask you about the Joan of Arc parallels?
Sure. Okay. Brienne falls into that category of somebody who, you know, you immediately want to make parallels between Joan of Arc. And there are a lot of parallels. Both of them, I think most importantly, exist in this kind of mythic ethos that it's hard to discern fact from fiction between, you know, who Joan of Arc was as a person and what she really did versus what the stories that were told about her. And Brienne, similarly, as the story will unfold, kind of falls into that category. She's mythic, both in nature and stature, but also some of her feats.
Now, I just for folks who don't really have a frame of reference, could you give us kind of a sketch of Joan of Arc? Like, when did she live? Yeah. What did she do? What was her legacy?
So Joan of Arc was born in 1412 in France. And at that time, France and England were sort of in the midst of the Hundred Years' War. So they're battling back and forth. And in the place where Joan of Arc lived, she lived in northeast France. And that was occupied by England at that time. So even including her hometown. So there's lots of kind of simmering tensions there. And then when she was about 13, she started hearing voices that she claims were sent from God. And these voices told her that she was supposed to save France by expelling the enemies. And at the same time, she took a vow of chastity and kind of dedicated herself to France and to the king. And When she was about 18 or 19 years old, she attracted a band of followers and somehow got a local magistrate to give her supplies and more supplies. And then she traveled to the place where the king was, the King Charles of France in Chinon, and he asked for an army. And he had heard rumors about this woman warrior, even though she was really untested, but believed her that God had given her the power to conquer or vanquish the enemy. And so he gave her what she asked for. And she ended up fending off the siege of Orleans in 1429. And she was dressed in white armor and riding a white horse, so the legends or so the stories say. She was eventually sort of quickly captured by the enemy and was put on trial for heresy. And was, because women are not supposed to be able to talk to God, and was ultimately convicted of heresy. And then was burned at the stake and died. So she lived a very, very short life, but really like the afterlife of her and the story of a woman warrior and the sort of the salvific figure that came in through this individual kind of extended and created a lore that lasted and persisted throughout the Middle Ages and even today.
And do we have a sense of a lot of times when women are presented in these old narratives, sometimes it will give you some description of their physique?
It depends on the sources, and a lot of the sources come after the fact. And so we know that she was described as being a maid, and so had presumably traditionally feminine features. We also know that she was mistaken for a man, in large part because she dressed herself. I mean, she cut her hair short. She, and this is all sort of rumor, dressed in men's clothing. Mm-hmm. She was commanded by essentially the Inquisition to kind of like take off her men's clothes and act like a woman. She agreed, but only momentarily, then went back to her room and kind of changed into men's clothing. And that was sort of the beginning of the end for her, or the final straw. Mm. So the resonance to Brienne in terms of looking like a man, to use those kinds of terms, are pretty striking. And I'll also say that the records show that I kind of postdated her a little bit. The approximate age at death was between kind of 17 and 19.
Okay. Yeah. And the reason that I ask about that is because some of our discussion of Brienne's gender does kind of hinge on the way that she's described and her clothing. Mm-hmm. In this chapter, she had to cast off a lot of her clothing. She did keep the cape, mm-hmm. and yet, you know, she's sort of piecemeal put together some of the men's clothing to put on, but they didn't quite fit her because she was even larger than the men. And so it's interesting that there is that sort of woman dressed in men's clothing thing that's happening with both of these. Do we have any kind of insight into what her motivations were? Was that just what she was most comfortable wearing, or she just didn't like what was on offer? Or do we have any insight into her?
I mean, I think it's a combination of all those things. It's really hard to ride a horse in a dress. But also she saw herself as being a leader, as a militaristic leader. And the model for militaristic leaders in that era was dressed in armor and, you know, dressed like a man. Mm-hmm.
So I do want to call out what I think is a really fascinating theological conversation between Kat and Brienne.
Yeah.
And I think this is sort of I think you have to read this as a departure from any kind of Joan of Arc parallel. Because of the stance that Brienne takes. But here's what the passage says. Catelyn glanced across the camp. Two men were walking sentry, spears in hand. I was taught that good men must fight evil in this world. And Renly's death was evil beyond doubt. Yet I was also taught that the gods make kings, not the swords of men. If Stannis is our rightful king, and then Brienne interrupts, he's not. Robert was never the rightful king either. Even Renly said as much. Jaime Lannister murdered the rightful king. After that, Robert killed his lawful heir on the Trident. Where were the gods then? The gods don't care about men no more than the kings care about the peasants. A good king does care. That's how Kat ends that conversation. We don't have a lot of theological insight into the Faith of the Seven. And yet, this is a really interesting theological conversation. Kat's taking the view, sort of like sometimes St. Paul will say things like this. He'll say things like, well, you know, the rulers of this world are put in place by God. And then other times, you know, Paul will kind of undermine that idea. Brienne's taking a very different view, and that is to say, gods are so far removed from the politics of this world that they don't even consider who's sitting on the throne. And the analogy that she gives is just like kings are really not concerned with what farmers are doing. Yeah. In this way, almost Brienne's almost taking kind of a deist point of view, where a cat traditionally theologically political, I suppose. So this is sort of, this would absolutely be a departure from Joan of Arc, right?
Yeah. And also think about it from Brienne's perspective, like why would she have that viewpoint? How would that benefit her own worldview? I think like if God doesn't care who sits on the throne, he's not paying attention to the minutiae of how social systems are ordered. He's not going to care what your gender is or your assigned gender is about who's being a knight. I think it's a really revelatory about how she's kind of identified or how she's made peace or kind of come to some sense of who she is and how that models.
Well, in addition to that, it's like, where's justice? Right? That's yeah. kind of like, Brienne is the kind of person who wants to do the right thing. She wants to enact justice in the world. And yet, if Renly can be killed by a shadow, where is it? Maybe the gods just aren't paying attention in that view. Yeah. Kat witnessed the same event and kind of came to a different theological conclusion. But they're kind of both working this out in real time. And I just thought it was a really interesting window into sort of two different views of how politics relate to the gods.
Right. Absolutely. I love that too. I think that you've done it. That's a really, really insightful observation. I love the idea that they're kind of working it out in real time, because this is just really the first moment in which they're trying to negotiate what their relationship is to each other and charting a path forward.
Mm-hmm. I almost feel like Brienne's sort of taking the voice of Ecclesiastes in the Hebrew Bible. Mm-hmm. She's almost saying, you know, something like, look, the life of the mortal is fleeting. And on a cosmic scale, it really doesn't matter. And we kind of can supply meaning if we try. But it's almost like she's in a sort of state of nihilism.
Yeah.
Not only is that interesting to me as sort of someone who does religious studies, but it's also interesting in the sense that we see, I think, two major differences between the book and the show. And the first is that Kat really does present as a very religious person. You know, she's praying in the Sept in the previous chapter. She's sort of praying for wisdom for her son in this chapter. And then, of course, the second difference in the show between the book and the show is that Brienne, I think there's more depth to Brienne in this on the pages. You really see her as a person who's a deep thinker, and I don't feel like that was really revealed in the show.
I totally agree with you. I think this serves as a really fascinating window. She's a multifaceted character, at least she's presented in this chapter, and we're allowed to see her. Mm-hmm. I think, as you pointed out, in a moment of tragedy, in a moment of pain, and in the show, sometimes I feel like her pain is reduced to being kind of the object of mockery and ridicule and having to defend herself, or being an object of like unrequited love, like someone who's unlovable. And that always irritated me. So, I love that. That's that he's it's much more nuanced.
All right. So one other thing about this little exchange between Kat and Brienne, and that is she introduces, in other words, Brienne introduces her perception of Jaime Lannister in this exchange. She says, Jaime Lannister murdered the rightful king. And I kind of feel like And the word murdered is italicized in the text. Yeah. And you really get a sense that she has a particular view of Jaime Lannister. It's repulsive to her. Like, how could someone on the Kingsguard kill the king? This is anathema. I mean, I'm kind of reading into the into the text, but you do hear the name Jaime Lannister on her lips for the first time here, and I thought that was interesting, just seeing how the arc of their relationship develops.
Mm-hmm. Bran's interesting because she also tends to see things in black and white. You just described her viewpoint theologically as nihilistic, which I would also agree. But while she may be, while she may view the relationship between the cosmos and or between heaven and earth as being, you know, kind of it doesn't matter or I'm not going to think about it, she has really, really definite opinions about people and about justice and about right and wrong. And so I think in addition to that, you get this whole sort of spew of, you know, like Renly's death was a murder, something that needs to be avenged, not part of this complicated kind of tragedy or unfortunate byproduct of war. And so that's what this driving sense of black and white thinking that that really propels her forward. And I think that to your point, when she was talking about Jaime Lannister, also serves as the breach. I mean, he teaches her, his relationship with her is the first kind of moment, and perhaps the only one, where she starts to see things in color. At least in the show.
Yeah. there's a couple other really interesting things about this chapter I want to call out here. So when they show up, when Kat returns to Riverrun, she sees three Lannisters hanging from the walls. Mm-hmm. Sort of a really public display of, you know, this is what we do to Lannisters. And this kind of shocks Kat at first. She's like, this, you murdered envoys. And this sort of repulses her. Like, how could you? That's political anathema. Then there's an explanation that they were false envoys. And one of the things that they said was, well, they were really here to try to free Jaime Lannister. And it's sort of, we see the fruition of Tyrion's plot, and it comes to naught. But one of the things that Edmure says is, they ate my food and drank wine at my table for 3 days. And then they did these acts of violence and tried to free Jaime Lannister and ended up murdering a few people. And I thought that was a little foreshadowing of the Red Wedding. They were under his roof, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Red Wedding is guided by a principle of polite conduct and, you know, sort of very spoken and articulated social norms about when you invite somebody to your house, then hospitality reigns supreme, and you don't murder, you don't do all these things. And absolutely, I mean, so the envoys were false because they did deliver a message, but they lied. And then they went beyond the bounds of what an envoy is supposed to do. They broke the, they made an oath. They had had an agreement, and they broke that social code. And when you break a social code, you're untrustworthy, and like all bets are off.
Right. And I think that it's sort of a little reminder that, yes, there are social norms, right? Mm-hmm. But they they absolutely can be broken. I mean, you said earlier in this conversation, of course, in Martin's world, the rules are almost made to be broken. And so you almost get the sense that people that put too much faith that people are going to act in a certain way because of the social consequences if they don't. I mean, those norms are only reliable until they're not.
Right. And so that even though we have social codes, there's and rules, there's always the risk and the very real risk that they're going to be violated or broken. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a lot of, and I think we have that today too, right? We trust that people are going to act in good faith, but we always go in with a little bit of an edge, or a little bit of a vein of suspicion mm-hmm. about them, prepared if they don't. And we don't carry swords with us, but we do carry the ability to email them or to yell at them or to do whatever.
Or to take legal action or whatever.
Or to take legal action against them, right, if they don't follow through with the contractual obligation, for sure.
At one point, her father is sort of, he's got his timelines mixed up, right? He's sort of like, he feels like he's living in a previous era of time, and he thinks he's talking with her sister. He thinks he's talking with Lysa. And he mentions that he doesn't want to hear any more about this stripling boy. And mm-hmm. I immediately thought, oh, he's talking about Peter Baelish. Mm-hmm. Is sort of making advances mm-hmm. on Lysa. And Lysa doesn't want to marry an older man. And I'm kind of reading between the lines here. But it kind of shows that Kat doesn't really have a full view of Baelish's relationship with her sister. Because right. she doesn't immediately think, oh, well, he's talking about Peter Baelish. She's like wondering, I wonder who he meant by the stripling boy.
Yeah, I think that that's going to be a, right. I was also, like I said, to back up that, like, serves as a revelation of Kat not only being an unreliable narrator, but a not a perfectly informed narrator.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
There's also a mention that Rob bypassed a fortress called the Tooth. And there is a little mention that he decided not to try to take the castle, but rather to sneak around it. And this is sort of like, how did he possibly do it? And the rumor is that he was guided by Grey Wind. Now, the only reason I bring this up is because I think this is the closest evidence we have that Rob has some kind of psychic connection with his wolf. Mm-hmm. That his wolf can find a goat trail and then Rob can follow it. Otherwise, we don't really have any insight into the warging abilities of Rob Stark, but I feel like this is maybe the closest we get to talking about that. And there is a mention, like, that's not a regular wolf. That wolf is that wolf was sent by the gods. So anyway, I thought that was notable to point out.
That is interesting.
All right. Introductions in the chapter, we hear of Thomas, or not Thomas the Rhymer. I was thinking about the actual guy. Rhymond the Rhymer, maybe historical analog to Thomas the Rhymer. But he's mm-hmm. He's a singer, and he's come to court to kind of pump up the reputation of Rob, and he's created a song called Wolf in the Night. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, if you want to be a good king in this world, you need at least one singer who's on your side, right? You need the propaganda machine, right? We meet Desmond Grell for the first time, and Utherides Wayne. And Robin Reiger. I think we might have met Robin Reiger once before. And then, of course, we meet for the first time Maester Vyman. You know, we're sort of introduced to Brienne's allegiance to Kat in this chapter, of course. Departures, notable departures. Well, the three false envoys are dead now. And then they freed Jaime for a moment, and he and Jaime got himself a sword and killed Paul, Penford, and Miles, who is a squire. So they both are introduced and depart from the narrative in this short telling of the exploits of Jaime Lannister. And I think we've already talked a little bit about the show differences. A lot of this is framed differently in the show, but I think that the most interesting thing to me is the difference in Brienne's character.
Absolutely.
And now part two of my conversation with Alicia about Edgar Allan Poe's House of Usher. A spoiler warning, we do indeed talk about some of the details of the short story, but at the point of this conversation, neither of us had watched any of the Netflix adaptation. So if you've read the short story, enter with caution. If you've read the short story and watched the entire Netflix adaptation, no worries at all. All right, here's Alicia. I feel like we should talk, before we talk about anything else, talk about kind of the setting, the world mm-hmm. that's created by this first segment of the story, which I think probably does point us in the direction of Martin, or at least Martin, at least, is consciously including homages to this setting.
Right.
And I was thinking Harrenhal, and I'm glad that you mentioned Harrenhal, because it affirms what I was thinking.
Yeah, because Harrenhal stands out amongst, you know, all of the buildings in the world of A Song of Ice and Fire as the one that, yeah, it just, something feels wrong about it. It just gives people a bad feeling.
Right.
Not just its lack of luck, but just something icky.
So I wanted to read this little section here and see if this struck you as interesting. About the whole mansion and domain, there hung an atmosphere peculiar to themselves and their immediate vicinity, an atmosphere which had no affinity with the air of heaven, but had reeked up from the decayed trees and the gray wall and the silent tarn, a pestilent and mystic vapor, dull, sluggish, faintly discernible, and leaden-hued. So I draw that out because it almost feels like there's this heaven and hell duality happening,
right,
in the story. And it almost feels like if you're living on the earth and you're breathing the air, you're a creature of heaven. Of course, hell's not too far away below your feet. But in this particular place, the atmosphere is not coming down from heaven. It's coming up from hell. That's kind of the sense I got from that paragraph. What do you think?
I mean, yeah, I guess it's linking to whatever this, they call it a dungeon, spelled, I guess, this 18th century way, D-O-N-J-O-N, where, yeah, and this is, again, we're in the spoiler territory, where once the sister passes away, they store her body, and they're creating this sense of dread connected with that mm-hmm. sort of makeshift crypt. And for me, that seems like the point of the story, that I wonder, you know, of course, you know, she gets back up at the end and she appears all bloody. And I guess we can assume it's a reliable narrator. He sees her. So that must have happened. But that could be medically possible. But I do wonder if this is one of those stories that's in that realm that I was taught in literary college, you know, was the fantastique, which is where it's not neither confirming supernatural elements or not. And maybe the sickness comes from within, from, you know, the sickness of this. I know they're going to play up this part in the Netflix adaptation, that's about like the sickness of this family and their clinging to money and power and what they'll do for that.
So, and this is something that Martin does a lot in his work, in that when he first introduces something that has a magical property, it doesn't smack you in the face as, hey, there's something supernatural happening here. It kind of almost disguises itself as, is this psychology? Is this superstition? You know, there might be is this literary illusion? You know, when you first encounter something like this in Martin's world, you think, well, there could be a lot of explanations for this. Magic isn't necessarily the only way to explain what's happening here.
Right.
And I almost feel like maybe he borrowed that from Poe. In this story, it's very much a psychological and physical condition that may or may not be related to kind of some hell-born curse or something. I mean, I guess you see that in a lot of horror as well. But it's sort of a slow burn into the horrific here.
But I feel like, I guess maybe you see it in a lot of horror because a lot of horror also pulls from Poe. I mean, of course, there were other, you know, you also cited Lovecraft earlier, but I don't think he's quite doing the same thing with, you know, he has that, they both explore that sense of dread. But Poe's really looking at the familial connections because, you know, he had a very complicated family life himself, becoming orphaned at a young age and raised by parents who never officially adopted him, and he had a tumultuous relationship with them throughout his life until that, you know, his foster mother also died. So he's writing from a place with a lot of familial strife himself and pain.
So I want to talk about the family element here because I'm really, you know, I'm halfway through rereading Clash right now, and I'm really getting the sense that repeated over and over and over in Martin's world is this in-world sensibility that you can predict what someone will do by looking at their family inclinations.
Right, you know, okay.
It's like, it's like Ironborn are always going to act like Ironborn. So why think that Theon is any different? Or, you know, Lannisters are always going to be greedy above everything else.
Right.
Or Freys are always going to be self-serving and cowardly and, you know, whatever. It almost feels like Targaryens are always going to conquer.
Right.
That's the kind of the feeling I get from Martin's world.
Yeah, especially with a character like Sansa, where the question becomes, well, is she a Tully or is she a Stark? It's not, you know, is she going to be her own person?
Right. And I think it's a very old sensibility. I lived for a couple years in central Illinois, and I've lived all over the world. I've lived in Canada and Zimbabwe and England, and I never felt more culturally alienated than when I was living in central Illinois, because there was a sense that if we don't know who your grandfather is, we can't trust you.
Right.
And I think that's a very old tribal view of things that I think can easily lead to prejudice. And so I think that in many ways, I think that there's a problem here that we experience in Clash, because it's like, if the Starks treated Theon better, maybe they would have had a different relationship with him in the end.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Do we hate Lannisters? You know, this is Catelyn sort of capturing Tyrion in book one or whatever. Would the story have unfolded if she didn't have a Lannister prejudice?
Well, I guess Jaime and Tyrion are the ones who only ones who somewhat defy their family expectations.
Right. Sure. Yeah. But in many ways, they are both, you know, they're both fighting for their family.
Right.
And, you know, I think that Tyrion absolutely is the person who's propping up Joffrey.
Right.
And of course, Jaime's going to do anything for his sister. Right. So,
yeah.
Even if they kind of feel the heaviness of doing that, maybe they hate their family. They're still going to be very tribal. But especially with the events of Clash, where Theon is basically kind of falling back into this old Ironborn.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this old Ironborn tradition.
Yeah.
No one is for the Ironborn. Everyone is against the Ironborn. And that is partially because the Ironborn is against everyone else.
Right.
And of course, maybe this is also going to play out in Theon's narrative. And my feeling is that, like, he's living into this family narrative that was decided 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, but I feel like a lot of people, if they move back to a conservative place that they're from, they might find themselves under the same pressures to conform.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And Theon has a problem with the drowned god, and he's trying to have a little healthy skepticism about that whole business. So anyway, I'm back to the House of Usher here. I feel like when do we know the main character's name? I probably.
I think they do. Oh, I don't have the book in front of me, but he does reference him once by name toward the end.
Okay, all right. When the POV character in this short story arrives and sees Roderick Usher, and he kind of repeats for the audience that this is their fate. This is always the fate of all of the members of House Usher, is that they have this malady that confounds physicians, and it shortens everyone's life, and they all kind of waste away toward the end. mm-hmm. even if they're very young people. And this is sort of the reputation of House of Usher, and this guy Roderick is absolutely buying into the story. And so you kind of feel like, is this a self-fulfilling prophecy, or is there something, you know, is there magic afoot?
Right, exactly. Especially with the drama of the last act. You know, is that an act of God or is that a coincidence?
Sure. I feel like we need a little bit of an excursus into sort of the deep Ironborn lore to understand what's happening here. Because I think it absolutely is going to help us understand the connections between Martin and Poe here.
Okay.
So I think everyone knows that, everyone listening to this podcast at least, will know that Harrenhal is named for someone named Harren the Black. And Harren the Black, you know, is sort of like almost a figure of legend, but he's left behind this massive house, right? This massive castle. And he is, he's Ironborn. So he is the king of the islands and riverlands. So it's really important to know that sort of this guy is Theon Greyjoy's ancestor, if not a direct relative or whatever. They both come from that Ironborn culture. And importantly, the Ironborn have this antithetical relationship between their mythology, their religion, the gods that they worship, and the Weirwood Tree Network. So this, to me, is a kind of crucial to understanding why Harrenhal is haunted. And I think that there's maybe a little kernel of that in the paragraph that I read, that there's something about the rotten soil that's coming up from the trees that's haunting right. this place. And so...
Okay, can I just interject yeah. one fun fact that yeah. there may be another Poe connection with the name Weirwood? There's a poem called Ulalum, and it's about a guy who's despondent one night, and he goes wandering and then realizes that he's subconsciously wandered into the crypt of who died a year before. And in that, they it's set in the so-called region of Weir, and he talks about in the poem, there's a line about the ghoul haunted woodland of Weir. Say that five times fast.
Fantastic. I love it.
Sorry.
No, that's fantastic. And I'll just reread this. An atmosphere which had no affinity with the air of heaven, but which had reeked up from the decayed trees, it says.
Mm-hmm.
So just to remind folks that, you know, the Ironborn worship the drowned god. And they view the weirwood trees as demon trees, and they call them the Yig, which I think is absolutely an homage to the Old Norse word for terrible. And, the Yig Drassil is sort of the great tree that connects the nine worlds mm-hmm. In Norse lore. And so the Ironborn are kind of based on Norse culture. So what they view the weirwood trees, not as of the old gods, they view them as the old demons. And so when Harren arrives at the God's Eye, Harren decides he's going to cut down weirwood trees to create the rafters of his great castle. And you kind of see that, like, this kind of bespeaks the old Ironborn enmity with the Yig. These demon trees are not to be worshipped, they're to be cut down and built with. And I think it's this, I think, homage to this Poe story, where the house itself, which is situated by a lake,
mm-hmm.
is absolutely haunted because its atmosphere comes up from the earth, from these rotting trees. Right. And it's not subtle at all. I feel like Harrenhal is an homage to the House of Usher.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think in both cases, yeah, it's in the House of Usher, it's sort of describing how the house is almost like rotting from its core, from its foundations, like the family.
Right.
But you know what other family I see a big parallel with is the Lannisters.
Okay.
And not just because they're twins, but because they are a family so consumed in their own greed that that they end up, well, what happens with, you know, for instance, the Lannisters in the main A Song of Ice and Fire series, you start to see them fall apart because they're being eaten from within by this greed.
Interesting. I mean, all right, so let's talk about the story a little bit more. Our man who's hanging out with, we should probably know his name.
I just looked it up and it doesn't say his name. It just says his best and only friend. You know what's interesting? I saw the preview for the House of Usher thing on Netflix, and it seems like they are not including the narrator. So we're getting it from Roderick's point of view.
That's so interesting.
And they also added a shape-shifting demon, so whatever, but...
Okay. So our POV character, who remains nameless, he spends some time with his friend, tries to lift his spirits. They do a little bit of music together. They do a little bit of art together. And after a while, you know, he spends enough time there that he actually sees the terrible fate of the sister, who seems close to death anyway. And they end up burying her alive? I mean, I guess that's a question, right?
Yeah.
Did they bury her or did they bury her alive? And I think
I mean, apparently she was alive in the end, yeah.
And I have heard it long, 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 many minutes, many hours, many days have I heard it, yet I dared not, oh, pity me, miserable wretch that I am. I dared not speak. We have put her living in the tomb. Said I not that my senses were acute? I now tell you that I heard her first feeble movements in the hollow coffin. I heard them many, many days ago, yet I dared not speak. And tonight, Ethelred, Ethelred, the breaking of the hermit's door and the death cry of the dragon and the clangor of the shield, say rather, the rending of her coffin and the grating of the iron hinges of her prison and her struggles within the coppered archway of the vault. Oh, whither shall I fly? Will she not be here anon? Is she not hurrying to upbraid me for my haste? Have I not heard her footstep on the stair? Do I not distinguish that heavy and horrible beating of her heart? Madman, I tell you, she now stands without the door.
All right. And given the kind of the connection between the Riverlands and Harrenhal, I wonder if this is where Lady Stoneheart comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, you know, the Tullys have this connection to the Greensight and...
Right, resurrected from the dead, covered in blood, yep.
Yeah, so it could be that that Lady Stoneheart is sort of an homage to Madeline Usher, who is drudged up from certain death.
Who fights her way out of... Because the worst part of the story, you know, the most horrifying part, is that her brother, who's, you know, she was his only companion, they were... twins, not quite in the Lannister way, but, you know, very, they were all each other had.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he could hear her scratching beneath, but didn't, was like too ashamed to let her out or something.
Yeah, gosh. It's just so horrible. And so, of course, she returns. And
right.
She returns as someone who has been buried alive. And so I do think that there's some kind of connection here between the Riverlands and the God's Eye Lake and the great cursed castle. And then eventually, you know, the resurrection of the sister here.
Yeah.
I noted a few other connections here, but I was wondering whether or not these twins, the twin brother and sister here. I wonder if this reminds you at all of any of the Targaryens that we meet along the way.
Well, yeah, like I said, my brain first went to Lannister with them, but I can see also a Targaryen connection. I think in the TV adaptation, it might be more like that. They might, but here we see them so reduced that we only, the only way we see, you know, we just hear descriptions of the decay, what's decaying in their house. And, you know, the fact that the brother is so pompous and full of himself is an indication that this is a family of who's used to having everything they say matter. But they're dying when we arrive. So we don't get to see them in like their dragon blazing glory. So it's more like, yeah, maybe, I mean, that there are some Targaryens that we could make that parallel to, like literally rotting on the throne.
Right. Yeah, I was just thinking like in terms of like the conversation we had earlier about the children of a particular house are going to act a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is, you don't see this anywhere more sort of in your face than with the Targaryen lineage. It's almost like there's this magic slash psychosis that goes into the makeup of the family tree or the family vine or whatever we want to call it. It's almost like you can't escape the family curse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's something here about, like you mentioned, sort of the greed aspect, like this kind of is intergenerational greed that's it's commenting on. But I also think that you could work this in with, like, we know that certain addictions will pass from generation to generation. So, you know, of course, we don't want to go too far down this road, but there is a sense in which, you know, the inclinations of the parents will absolutely bleed into the fates of the children. You could do that with addiction. You can do that with certain kinds of psychological conditions, whether it's by way of nature or nurture. There are certain, for lack of a better term, there are certain sins that don't just affect the person who commits the act.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain sins that will be felt, you know, for generations to come.
Absolutely.
And I kind of feel like Martin likes to play with that. And then, of course, here we have these children of Usher.
But one interesting difference is that unlike the Targaryens, where there's a lot of infighting, they make clear that the Usher family has but one lineage all the way down. You know, they did not branch. So they're sort of keeping, you know, because there was a lot of problems back during that time with wealthy families where there'd be a lot of children and they divide up the properties and the land holdings just get smaller and smaller and smaller. Mm. So by having one line, they're keeping everything straight down the lineage until this final collapse.
Well, it doesn't explicitly say it in the story, but it does make me wonder, like, is this a Targaryen vine problem? Meaning that most trees branch out because you marry outside the family, but the Targaryens marry within. And of course, we see that both the brother and the sister have not married and they've not left the house and they've become very insular in this way.
Right. I think, because we see with the Targaryens when they do marry out, it's like if there are two different branches of Targaryens existing, their instincts will be to prune each other.
Yes, of course. I really enjoyed rereading this, and I think that it's kind of undeniable that this had some kind of influence on the Harrenhal plot. And, you know, maybe it's just a little headcanon on my part, but I think maybe did plant a seed for the Lady Stoneheart plot as well.
Right. I think, you've convinced me of that. That makes sense.
Do you have any more that you'd like to point out?
No, I just, you know, if people read this story and are curious about the Pit and the Pendulum, I think the more you read of Poe, the more you're going to be like, oh, that reminds me so much of this character or this motif.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you brought up the homage to the wood of the wood of Weir. And what story was that again?
It's a poem called Ulalain.
Okay, all right, that's right. Okay, I'm so glad that you mentioned that because I had no idea about that.
Yeah, I mean, but it also some people say that that comes from the last name of someone from, I think it was the Rolling Stones or something.
Oh no, Grateful Dead, and I know that Martin's a big Deadhead, and I think Bobby Weir would be sort of a good guess. He does include from time to time homages to bands that have been important to him. But it doesn't.
But the fact that it's
be,
a wood.
Yeah, right. It doesn't necessarily have to be an either or thing. I don't think.
No, that's true.
Alicia, thank you so much for your time. And what is Wool Shift Dust covering presently?
Yeah, so we are, despite the Dune delay, we will be continuing with at least the first part of that coverage. And then, of course, yeah, in October, we have a special episode coming out for talking about the Netflix adaptation of The Fall of the House of Usher. And there will be a special bonus reading with sound effects of the story by Poe in the Wool Shift Dust Book Club.
Oh, fantastic.
Free for book club members.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.